What's the story with this one? Royce asked. Why does the man have three swords? Ah! The merchant grinned at them both, and Hadrian noticed how all his teeth were yellow and crooked. This carving is a beautiful work of art created to commemorate the greatest warrior in the world. Galanti, the tiger of Mandalin, the hero of Calais, the courtier of the queen, the bane of the Baran gazelle.
I'm hungry. Aren't you hungry?
Hadrian clapped his palm to his stomach.
I think there's a place that sells meat on a stick over there. Smells great. Ever have meat on a stick?
Greatest warrior in the world, eh? Royce asked. That's hard to believe.
Only those who have never seen him fight, I would imagine. He was already well known for his battles against the gazelle when he arrived in Mandalin. But it was his victories in the arena that brought about his conquest of the queen.
Is that so? Royce took down his hood and smiled at Hadrian. And who is this queen? The man turned and plucked another figurine from his inventory. This one of a beautiful, sultry woman with slanted eyes painted in decorative outlines. She had a round, doll-like face with a small pouting mouth accentuated by brilliant red lips. She wore a hat with pheasant feathers and a silken dress that appeared no more than paint on the figure.
Rhea Reis Ramsay, the illegitimate daughter of the King of Calais. Her half-brother, Lemuel Ramsay, ordered her death. But Rhea Reis escaped and retreated to the one place she knew her brother would never look, the east. She followed the Esti River into the ancient Erbon region in the center of the country. There, she rediscovered the ruins of Orlinius. She claimed the ancient imperial city as her own and renamed it Mandalin. Her restoration of the old arena and resumption of the games made her quite popular. Now she rules eastern Calais, while her brother rules the west from Rolando.
Oh, so she's still alive.
Very much so. Rhea Reis is notorious. Living on the fringe of civilization, she manipulates Tenkin warlords by day and battles the Baran gazelle at night. She has the beguiling beauty of a starry constellation and is as seductive and dangerous as a viper. For nearly 2 years, Galanti was her paramour and she his patron. The two swam in lakes of liquor, beds of tulan leaves, and pools of blood, until his last fight.
He pointed at the other statue.
They call Galanti the Tiger of Mandalin because he battled against a great striped cat.
Last fight. That statue shows him victorious. Did the beast eventually kill him? The merchant laughed.
No, no. Galanti could never be defeated. Like all good legends, he simply disappeared.
The man made a flamboyant show of throwing his hands up as if releasing a dove to the heavens. Then he halted as he looked at Hadrian. The vendor's eyes narrowed as they shifted focus from one sword to the next. Royce turned to Hadrian.
What do you think? Maybe my missus would like this one. Should I get it?
Hadrian frowned and walked away.
I'm getting something to eat.
Royce didn't buy either statue. This didn't surprise Hadrian. There was no way Royce would walk around with a 1-foot figurine under his arm. Nor could he see him riding back to Melengar with it strapped to the back of his saddle. Thus, Hadrian didn't find it odd when Royce joined him at the Urbanese tea house without either gift for the missus. But he was surprised when Royce's only question was, "What do they serve here?" Partially in the street and on the edge of the traffic flow, the café provided a grand view of the city's human parade. The two sat at one of a dozen wobbly tables, which were nestled under an outdoor thatch-covered pavilion. The structure did little to block the wind or sun. The proprietor was a native Albanian, but all he did was greet the customers. The ones doing the work were Calais immigrants.
"If it's authentic fare," Hadrian replied, "rice and tea. Although, if you're adventurous, you could try hohura, that's a Calais liquor. If you're absolutely insane, you could get a mug of Gerlin Bog, goblin liquor that hisses and tastes like something a campfire vomited. I think I'll avoid intoxicants for the time being. Then you'll want to steer clear of anything with Dreneste in it. And they tend to put the herb in everything. I once had a fabulous stew. 10 minutes later, I passed out." Royce peered at him with a grimace. "You're making me long for the meat house. But this place has chairs and a better view."
Few areas of the city had thus far matched Little Gurum for activity and interest, and Hadrian revised his assumption that the name was derogatory. Perhaps it began that way, as the real Gurum was as universally cherished as black fever, which was often contracted in the selfsame jungle. Still, the Gurum was wild, colourful, fragrant, and bursting with life. In this way, it was mirrored by the Calaisian district of Rochelle. Hadrian remembered Calais as overwhelming to the senses, grand bazaars and vast markets set in old cities on the ocean coast, of vibrant villages in the dense brush. But here, the experience was jammed into a tiny urban neighbourhood of stone buildings and cobbled walkways. It was indeed a jungle of sorts. Without a word, a barefoot man in a long, unadorned tunic delivered a communal bowl of rice and vegetables, which was accompanied by a plate of piled flatbread and dark tea. The food was so hot, it steamed. Hadrian knew the dish as fried canas. Royce sniffed it dubiously, then waited until Hadrian took a bite before joining in.
"How come you didn't ask me about mandolin?"
"You mean all that stuff the guy said about the queen and a tiger and arena fights?"
"Yeah."
"The truth?" Royce asked.
"Sure."
"Not interested."
"Really?"
Hadrian set down his tea, surprised.
"A man tells you this fantastic story about bloody battles and a notorious queen of Calais, and you aren't even mildly curious?"
"If our pasts aren't our present, there's likely a reason."
"So you won't ask me, and I shouldn't ask you?"
"Something like that. Besides, I'm sure in a contest of bygone horrors, I've got you beat."
Hadrian peered across the lip of his steaming cup.
"You think so?"
"You don't."
Royce appeared genuinely surprised.
"A whole city still has nightmares about me."
Hadrian nodded, then hooked a thumb back in the direction of the merchant.
"You weren't paying attention. An entire country knows about my murderous past."
"Maybe, but they like you. No one is making carvings of me."
"In Calais, they also craft the likeness of death and pestilence. They're an odd people."
"He didn't talk about you like you were a scourge."
"Because all he knows is the myth. Have you ever wondered how a soldier of fortune could be so..."
Hadrian paused to take a sip of his tea.
"Naive," Royce offered.
Hadrian swallowed.
"I was going to say optimistic."
"Really? I suppose it could be described like that."
"Yeah. I've puzzled over that one for some time. Most mercenaries are a bit more... jaded and cynical," Hadrian offered.
"I was going to say realistic and practical."
"Really? I suppose it could be described like that. But what you might not be considering is that maybe I'm on the return trip."
"Huh? Do you have nightmares of people you killed?"
"No."
"There you go." "There I go what?"
Hadrian took the clay pot left on their table and poured tea into his cup until it overflowed. "Every cup is different, but each can only hold so much. Eventually you either stop pouring or make an awful mess. Make a big enough mess, and you have to clean up. You have to change.
Hadrian looked at the pool of tea dripping through the slats of the wobbly table.
I made a really big mess, and it wasn't tea I spilled. They were both looking at the puddle of tea when the screaming started.
Chapter 12. Unicorns and Polka Dots. Up the street, where an alley divided a makeshift livestock shelter from an old stone building, a crowd began to form. The animal pen was nothing more than rope strung between driven stakes, hemming in a score of sheep. At front, alongside a hastily assembled stage, was a hand-painted sign that read, Sunset Auction. With its white marble blocks and pillars, the three-story stone building opposite the alley gave the impression of having once been a place of importance, a counting house or a court. Now the upper windows were laden with drying clothes, and the balconies brimmed with spinning wheels, jugs, baskets, and pots. A number of families roosted in the vacuum of cracked marble neglect. Most of them had rushed to balconies and peered down. Several pointed at the alley below. Hadrian swallowed the last of his canasse and stood up. His height allowed him to see over the crowd, but granted him no further insight.
"What's going on?" Royce asked, not bothering to stand.
"Dunno. Something happening in the alley.
Nothing good by the sound of it."
The screams had stopped, but were replaced by a chorus of wailing.
"Where are you going?"
Royce asked as Hadrian pushed forward.
"To see what happened."
"Whatever it is, they have plenty of people to deal with it, and screams and cries are never portents of good fortune. I'd stay away."
"Of course you would."
What ability Hadrian lacked in deftly dodging his way through a shifting populace, he more than made up for in cutting through a dense crowd. People moved clear for a man of his size. Those who didn't, he could move. Any resistance to a gentle push was instantly stifled when they spotted his swords. The city's residents didn't carry steel. Most couldn't afford it, and few had the need. Farmers, merchants, and tradesmen rarely faced violence beyond the occasional drunken fistfight. Theirs was a life of endless repetition, where, if they stayed in their place and hoed their given row, nothing of great note ever happened. Men of steel were different. A man with a trowel and hod sought to lay bricks. A man with a sword sought to lay men low. A man with three swords, you quickly avoided. It was in this manner that Hadrian worked his way forward until he was at the mouth of the alley. That was where the crowd stopped. While everyone was eager to see what the noise was about, few cared to get close. Content to view from a distance, the mob hung back, leaving a corridor open. In a city as congested as Rochelle, the refuse needed to go somewhere. In the finer districts, waste was deposited into the Roche River, which carried it out to the bay and then the Goblin Sea. Poor neighborhoods like Little Gurham made do by jamming their rubbish behind the buildings, in alleys. So, finding a vast mound of garbage at the end of the alley wasn't a surprise. Broken crates, torn cloth, rotting food, animal waste, and bones were all piled high. But in this case, a handful of kneeling women wailed before the heap. A smaller number of men stood nearby, looking aghast and bewildered as they stared down at what appeared to be trash being dragged from the pile. For the most part, it was. A little cascade of rubbish had been formed where someone had been digging. People did that. Hadrian knew that even men and women of means went treasure hunting in trash piles for a lark. Stories always circulated about someone finding gold earrings or an overlooked sack of silver, but the best prize Hadrian personally knew to have been found was a torn leather belt, long enough to be repurposed for a thinner man.
This time, someone had apparently found more than they bargained for. No one likes to pick up a discarded shoe and find a foot inside. The women wailed over the body of a child. A little girl, no older than 6 or 7, was dead. Hadrian knew dead bodies. He'd walked the aftermath of too many battlefields not to know the child had died only hours ago. Certainly less than a day. But there was more than just death involved with this body. As Hadrian approached, as he reached the scene and took his place beside the other befuddled men, he understood the problem. The little girl hadn't been murdered. She'd been torn apart. Her face was fine, her mouth partially open, her eyes thankfully closed. He had killed more men than he could remember, and been in battles where women and children had died. He'd lost his squeamishness to gore long ago, but never grew accustomed to the sight of open-eyed, dead children. The girl's rib cage had been broken into, its contents rifled through. Without needing to get closer, Hadrian could tell something was missing. The child's heart was gone. "We should go," Royce whispered. The thief was behind him, motioning with a hand for them to retreat. "Soldiers coming." His warning came too late.
"You really need to listen to me more often," Royce told Hadrian as the two sat in the guard post.
This was a different station house than where they had chatted with Roland, but the interiors were identical. Same one-room shack with a desk, weapons, stacks of wood, and a small fire. An identical horseshoe held down similar parchments. The military was nothing if not consistent.
At least the shackles remained on the wall rather than on their wrists.
The guardsmen had confiscated Hadrian's swords, missed Royce's dagger on the pat-down, and after some preliminary questions, ordered them to wait.
"We're not in trouble," Hadrian said. "The truth is, we've done nothing wrong."
Royce closed his eyes and shook his head.
"By Mar, the way you think, it's... I honestly don't know if there's a word for it. You realize the truth is rarely important, right?"
"Soldiers are people too," Hadrian replied.
"I know. I was one."
"I wasn't limiting the observation to soldiers. Most people don't care about the truth.
Look, they have no reason to do anything to us. We're innocent. They just picked us up because we're strangers and didn't belong in that alley.
They're just double-checking.
Reason, truth, innocence."
Royce sat back against the wall and folded his arms.
"Unicorns, pixies, and dragons. You're not that young to believe in such things. How is it that you fancy yourself a resident of a make-believe world?"
"I told you, at this point, it's a choice."
"It's not. It's fooling yourself. I can decide between eating fish or pork, but I can only pretend to eat unicorn meat. I can't actually eat a unicorn. The world is the world, and you live in it with open eyes or choose to be blind. It's all the same to me, but don't stand there pretending you're right."
Hadrian grimaced.
"There are so many things wrong with that statement."
Only Royce could think of a unicorn-eating metaphor.
"Where do thoughts like that bubble up from? Why a unicorn? Who thinks of eating a symbol of purity and grace?"
Maybe that was his point. Perhaps Royce was making an argument within an argument. But Hadrian wasn't about to be sucked down some obscure sewer where only Royce knew the way. Hadrian had a point of his own.
"You always wear black and grey. That's a choice too, and it says a lot about you."
"It says I don't like to be seen at night." "It says you like to hide, and people who like to hide are usually up to no good. That's a message you declare to everyone you meet, and people receive it as you might expect. Then
When others don't trust you, when they avoid you, hurt or arrest you for doing nothing, your worldview is justified. So, you're right. You can't eat unicorns in your world because they don't exist. But they do in mine. Probably because, in my world, we don't eat them.
Royce furrowed his brow, his mouth partially open, as if he was hearing a sound he couldn't understand.
Honestly, I think you should try wearing purple and yellow, Hadrian said. Something bright and happy. Polka dots, maybe. And you should smile more. People would treat you differently. You might find the world a brighter place.
Tell me you aren't serious.
Hadrian chuckled. About the yellow polka dots? Of course not. You'd look ridiculous, and you might attract children, which would be a mistake on an epic level.
And the unicorn stuff?
You brought unicorns into this. I have no idea where that came from. It's like you have a demented recipe book or something. Which, if you do, please don't tell me.
Are you two always like this?
The guard behind the desk had stopped his scribbling and was staring at them with an expression of utter bewilderment.
He is, they both said in unison.
You're hilarious.
The guard smiled. I sure hope you're not guilty. I'd hate to have to hang the two of you. Good, Hadrian said. At least we can agree on something.
Sounds like unicorn believer talk to me.
The guard grinned.
Personally, I'm with Dark Clothes guy. Living is anguish, and then you die.
Wow. That's uplifting, Hadrian said. You should start your own church.
He shook his head. Not the religious type.
There's a surprise.
The problem with the world, the guard went on, is that too many people don't see it like it is. They want it to be something it just isn't. I think everything would be better if folks stopped believing in fantasies and dealt with the way things are. We might actually improve things then. I mean, there aren't any unicorns or fairies, and there certainly isn't an heir of Novron who's going to appear and save us all. That's just stupid.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Royce pointed at the guard.
I really hope you don't try to hang me. I'd hate to have to kill you.
The guard looked confused again. Then, assuming Royce was making a joke, he laughed.
Royce laughed, too. Hadrian didn't, and this served to remind him he didn't have his swords.
They were by the door. He could see them. And that made him feel better, because the truth was that Royce and the guard had a point. Sometimes things didn't work out the way they should. They certainly hadn't for that little girl in the alley. The door to the guard post opened, and a familiar face entered.
Blackwater?
Roland asked, puzzled.
My, aren't you making the rounds?
He looked to the desk guard.
Drake, what are they doing here? We picked them up in the alley where the Mir was killed, the soldier said with a salute. The big one had those three swords, and the other looked, well, suspicious.
It's the color of his clothes, Hadrian offered. Makes him look sinister.
You know them, sir?
Yes. This is Hadrian Blackwater, an old friend. Not the sort to murder children, believe me.
Roland turned his gaze on Royce, but hesitated to add any clarification.
Apparently, I need to wear polka dots, Royce said.
What were the two of you doing in Little Gurham?
Having our midday meal, Hadrian said. I was introducing Royce here to Calais cuisine. We were at an outdoor cafe when we heard the shouts and went over to investigate.
Still the soldier, eh?
Roland chuckled.
He turned to the guard. Is that really all you have on them, Drake?
They were there and looked suspicious.
The guard nodded.
Pretty much.
Give them back their belongings, then.
The guard moved to the door and gathered Hadrian's swords.
Sorry for the inconvenience, Roland told them.
He glanced down at the desk, pivoted the top page so he could read it.
Looks like we'll have to add this one to the pile.
What's that mean? Hadrian asked.
taking the spadone first and slinging it over his shoulder. Roland, who didn't appear to have had time to shave in a week, scrubbed his growing beard and sighed.
I told you about the murders we've been having. Mere tend to be the targets. And we can be thankful for that. If it had been the child of a citizen, a guild merchant or tradesman, or, Novron forbid, a noble, I'd have the constable crawling all over me. But because it was a mere, you'll ignore it? Royce asked.
No, not ignore. There's really nothing I can do in any case. But there would be more pressure.
Roland looked to the guard, who handed Hadrian's other two swords over.
No witnesses, right? The soldier shook his head. As usual, no one knows anything.
It's always the same, Roland said.
No one sees them. No one knows a thing. Then the next victim turns up in the river, or pit, or an alley. Each one ripped open, heart missing.
Roland checked on the contents of the pot near the fire, and grunted when he found it empty.
Don't you think that's a little odd? Royce asked.
You'd think that, wouldn't you? But no, not any more. I may have mentioned that life is cheap down here on the east side, even cheaper next door in the rookery, which is where most of the killings have occurred.
But to rip out the hearts of children? Hadrian asked.
This made him think of Royce roasting unicorns. Only this was the real-world form of that idea.
Could that be a purer example of evil? Why would anyone do such a thing? And how? How does a person kill and crack open a ribcage without anyone seeing or hearing it?
Probably selling them on the black market, Roland said, with enough callousness to make Hadrian wonder what had happened to the young man he once knew. Some of these Calaeans used them to make youth potions or healing balms. Spreading a little powdered baby heart on your face will keep you looking young, or so people have been told. Rich merchants' wives are their market. We try to stop it, but there's not much we can do. Usually they use calf or lamb hearts, but someone is obviously making an extra effort. If people think they're getting the real thing, the price goes up. When news of a death spreads, the demand is higher.
Dealing with frequent loss of children's hearts and the indifference of bystanders has driven the unicorns out of Roland's world as well, Hadrian realized.
Such beliefs made sense and were difficult to debate. After all, horrors had a way of grabbing the limelight and diminishing everything else.
How can anyone believe that people are basically good when faced with such blatant evidence to the contrary?
What Hadrian couldn't make Roland, Drake the Guard, or least of all Royce understand, was that a life barren of unicorns was existence without purpose. Hadrian had visited that dark land once. He'd lived as a glutton of selfishness, reclining on the luxury of visible truths. He drowned himself in wine and blood, but the more he consumed, the emptier he felt. What was the point if, as Drake so eloquently put it,
living is anguish, and then you die?
Hearing those words convinced Hadrian of the importance of unicorns. Even if there weren't any, it was absolutely necessary to believe they existed. What's more, he needed to try to find them. It wasn't much. Chasing fantasies was a thin thread to justify a life. And yet, how many wonders had been wrought by people who did exactly that? Those who believed in crazy dreams.
Sorry for the mistake, Roland said. I'd buy you both a drink, but I have the night shift the rest of this week. And the Duke frowns on drunk officers.
Ah, yes. The life of an honest soldier, Hadrian mused, feigning envy.
How about you two? Still looking for the Duchess? Heard you stop by the carriage shop. Find anything?
Nothing yet.
Let me know if you do. I'm pretty sure she's dead, but if she isn't...
What?
Roland hesitated, and his face changed. The tough facade, the soldier's stare, dimmed, and for a moment Hadrian once more saw the lad he had once known.
Everyone calls her the Whiskey Wench. No one showed her a lick of respect. I didn't either. Guards are supposed to bow when she goes by. None of us did. We all said how she wasn't a real noble. That she was fake because she wasn't born one, and wasn't even from Alburn. I guess the feeling came from a kind of envy. As if she was getting away with something and didn't deserve respect. Then, well, she gave me a new pair of boots. My old ones had holes in them. My feet used to get soaked, and I nearly got frostbitten more than once. I hardly ever saw the woman. It's not like I was her bodyguard, but she must have noticed. Why she bothered, I don't know. Told myself she didn't like seeing a guard captain in a shoddy uniform, except city guards are required to wear black boots, thin leather that looks nice, but doesn't do anything when you're out patrolling in the cold. He lifted his foot to show Hadrian his pair of brown, fur-lined footwear. Nicest boots I've ever owned. Real warm. Hardly noticed the snows the rest of the winter. He put his foot down. If she's alive, I want to know. And if she's not, and you discover who did it, I want to know that too. Hadrian nodded and, checking his weapons, pushed the short sword down on his hip and lifted the bastard sword higher and back a tad. Well, thanks for helping us out. Hadrian took two steps toward the door, but stopped when he realized Royce wasn't following. Across the roadway stood a busy counting house. Like many of the important buildings, it was constructed of stone that had grown dingy. Seeing it, Royce turned back and caught Roland's attention. Can you answer a question for me? He pointed at one of the sculpted decorative faces on the building across the street. Why are these things everywhere? They crouch under steps, frame windows, perch on ledges, and hold up everything from bridges to balconies. Even some of the cobblestones have tiny grotesque faces carved into them. Why is that? Roland dipped his head to see beyond the doorframe. You mean the gargoyles?
Royce nodded. I've seen them before. They're used to channel rainwater off big churches, like the cathedral in Medford. But here, they're all over. Most don't even serve any real function.
Only a few are being used to divert runoff.
Roland pushed up his lower lip.
Just decorations, I suppose.
There's no story behind them. Roland rolled his shoulders.
Sure, there's multiple stories, but they're all nonsense. Humor me. The most popular one has a priest who slays a dragon with the help of a condemned man. They burn the beast afterward, but the head isn't affected. You know, on account of it being able to breathe fire and all. So, the local bishop decides to mount the thing on his cathedral to scare off evil spirits. Seemed like a good idea, so stonemasons were asked to add them from that time on.
Uh-huh, Royce said, dissatisfied.
Well, there's another one about the town's founding. A crazy architect by the name of Bradford Crummin was commissioned to lay out the city. He chose the place for the estate, Grom Gallimus, and most of the old buildings. He was brilliant, but also insane. He claimed to hear voices. Ghosts, he called them. And the only way he could shut them up was to scare the spirits away. Apparently, they were terrified by scary faces, so he put all these grotesque creatures around.
Royce didn't say anything, just folded his arms.
Okay, so there's another one. Seems they never used to be here. The city went up and all the buildings were plain, but functional. Then one day this swarm of creatures swooped down and overran the place. The town was swamped, and everyone was afraid to go outside. Didn't know where they came from. But a few days after the invasion, an old wizard comes hobbling along. He agreed to rid the town of the creatures for a price.
The city agreed,
and he turned them into stone, but... But the town didn't pay, Royce said.
You've heard this?
Royce shook his head.
No, but stories are all the same, aren't they?
Roland thought a second, then shrugged.
Anyway, you were right. They refused to pay. Since the creatures were all dead, their problem was solved. Let me guess. The wizard does something nasty.
Roland nodded.
He cursed the town. Now every night, usually in the dark of a new moon, the stone creatures come alive and exact revenge.
Royce frowned. Never mind. I was expecting something awful, but also believable.
We're talking monstrous faces here. What would be believable?
How about the stone carvers charged by the hour?
Why the sudden interest in architecture?
Hadrian asked, as he once more followed Royce back into Little Gorham.
Didn't you notice?
Royce was once more moving quickly, nearly trotting, retracing their earlier trip back to the scene of the crime.
Notice what?
They came upon the same square where they'd spilled the tea, and Royce pointed up at the building near where the girl's body was found.
What about it? See the gargoyles lining the ledge up there?
The old building was adorned with regularly spaced, creepy, monkey-like statuettes along the third-floor exterior. They weren't really gargoyles, not in the traditional sense. These didn't funnel rainwater. They were merely decorations.
So?
Royce frowned.
See the gap?
The row of hunched, fanged monkeys leaned forward, holding up the top balcony with their shoulders. But Royce was right. One was missing. The rogue stone monkey monster second from the left had abandoned his post, leaving the other little monsters to do all the work. Such a massive weight hitting the ground from that height would have produced a lot of damage, not to mention debris. But the street below didn't show any signs of an impact. Hadrian's next thought was that it had been removed, perhaps in need of repair. But doing so would have required scaffolding and a hoist, neither of which was present. And the empty place showed no evidence of excavation, just a space for a carving that wasn't there. The statue looked to have simply flown away. The most sensible answer, and the one he concluded with, was that the gargoyle had never been installed in the first place. Maybe the builders had been short a figure. Likely, there was some story that went along with it. The kind of tale that people shared to show off their knowledge of local lore.
Oh, yeah, Grimbald the Carver dropped over dead when working on it, and out of tribute to him, no replacement was ever made.
Or maybe something like, someone miscalculated the number of statues for that wall, and old Pete started installing from the right and Bradford from the left. It wasn't until they were done that they realized they were short by one. Funds were low, so the missing gargoyle wasn't made. The problem with these neat and sensible explanations was the bare spot, bright and pristine, like a sun-bleached carpet with a square of vivid color where a cabinet had once stood. The wall bore a clean silhouette where a statue should have been. Something had been there. But now, it wasn't. Royce looked at Hadrian and asked, "Why is one missing?"
Chapter 13 Grom Gallimus. Vilar Orfi waited where he usually did, on top of a roof. He had several favorites, but that evening he sat on the peak of the Trio Vestments building, where a tailor, a haberdasher, and a cobbler came up with the idea of a one-stop shop for men's clothing. Vilar had never seen the inside of the Trio V, but he was quite familiar with the roof, which hid his home.
Tucked in a hidden niche formed by hips and gables, his abode was less a house and more a tented nest built of canvas and discarded wood that he had dragged up at night like a giant owl. His tiny shelter was filled with the few things he valued. A sarafan plant that he kept alive in a wooden cup, a torn bit of tapestry, and a sword left to him by his grandfather. That last item he mounted under the eave, so even if someone found his nest, they might not see it. He also had some food reserves, roots, nuts, and berries that he'd gathered on the outskirts of town. The berries were just starting to appear on the warm, sunny hillsides, and he'd found some mushrooms as well. He'd also hauled in a few treasures uncovered in the trash on Governor's Isle. Someone down there didn't like salted fish. The sun was still up, which kept Vilar's head down. He didn't like moving about in the daylight. He was blessed with the distinctly beautiful features of his people, and refused to cover his ears or hide his eyes from the world. He was proud of his heritage. The rest of the world should be ashamed. Vilar's list of shoulds was long. He should be able to walk into Triovese and buy a new suit of clothes. He should be able to wear his grandfather's sword on his hip in public. He should be able to live in a house with four walls and have an honest-to-feral pot for his salafan plant. What should be, and what was, however, remained widely divergent. And this kept him hunkered down, with his back against the cupola, where the pointing, well-dressed man, Weathervane, proclaimed an easterly wind. He often mused on what would happen if he dared wear the sword. It wasn't illegal. He'd heard that some rulers disallowed blades and bows inside city limits, except for those worn by knights, nobles, and city guards. Rochelle didn't have a weapons law, but then there was no edict against a mere walking into the Triovee, either. Some rules didn't need to be written down or enforced by the guard. If he was seen with the sword brazenly clapping his thigh, he'd draw looks. Then a crowd would form, and unless he was willing to use the weapon, they would beat him and rip it away. If he used it, if he acted like any other self-respecting person, the city guard would come. While wearing a sword wasn't illegal, wounding and killing people most certainly was. Vilar knew from experience that the guards didn't like dwarves, barely tolerated Calaeans, but absolutely hated Mir. Vilar had no illusions of being able to fight off a squad of trained soldiers. He had no training with a blade, and he'd never been in a fight. He didn't consider being beaten the same as being in a fight. So, while being a Mir was reason enough for a beating, being a Mir with a sword was guaranteed suicide. Looking down between his feet, he could see the river and the setting sun as it turned gold. Carriages rolled across the distant bridges. Smoke rose from countless chimneys. Crowds crawled along the canyon streets, flowing like some viscous slime that oiled the workings of the city. He was literally above it all. But soon he'd add a more figurative aspect to that idea. The bells of Grom Gallimus began to play their lonesome melody, marking the end of the day. He should be going. The bishop wouldn't appreciate him being late. He started to rise, then paused. He heard the scraping again. Tiny claws on wood. The rat is back. Vilar looked to his pile of possessions in time to see the black-and-white spotted rodent scurry into a crack in the roofing. The thief was at it again. This time he had gotten the box open. Vilar fished the old wooden container out of his pile and, in a panic, he searched the contents while guarding against any mischief that the demon wind might be plotting. Everything that had been there appeared safe.
He drew out his most cherished possession, a small portion torn from a tapestry that was at least 1,000 years old. According to the story his grandfather told, the tapestry had belonged to the Orphe family, and had once been the size of a 3-story wall. This 2-foot scrap was all that remained. The rest had been confiscated and burned by the church, for obvious reasons. Even Villar's little scrap showed the detailed image of pointed-eared heroes in armor, riding horses and holding swords aloft. This, his grandfather had told him, was a depiction of the fall of Meridied. The image commemorated the battles against barbarians that eventually brought low the ancient and magnificent imperial province, a place that had once been ruled by Mir, for Mir. Villar spread the bit of tapestry across his thighs and lovingly caressed the fine needlework. A Mir had ruled a province. He stared into the thread-woven eyes of the faces and made them a promise. If Feral is willing, another one will yet rule a kingdom. Seeing the sun touch the distant mountains, Villar lifted the cloth to his lips and kissed the image, then folded it and put the torn corner back. Time was growing short, and he had much to do. Villar took his usual rooftop highway route to the cathedral, dropping down in the shadow of the alley. With the workday over, the mass migration of weary people slogged home. Shoulders slumped, heads bowed. Few looked up. Even if they had, even if they saw him, no one would have noticed, or cared about, another Mir on the street. The sun was dipping behind the estate, most of its face gone, its power fading. A host of shadows crept out of the low places and claimed dominion over the world. The coin of chance was flipping. At last, Tails was coming up. His kind couldn't safely enter most shops, but a few proprietors were sympathetic and looked the other way when a Mir slipped in. Those rare merchants would only sell to Mir if no one else was in the store. Common practice was to wait and watch for a lull in traffic, then slip in, buy what was needed, and hurry back out before anyone saw. If someone did see, the Mir would be turned away. The Crow Tavern, on the east side, went a step further. Each night they threw bones and unwanted leftovers on the street for the Mir from the nearby rookery to grab. A crowd gathered religiously and fell to their knees, gathering what they could carry in arms or the folds of skirts. Villar had witnessed the event only once. That was all he could stomach. He had felt nauseated and decided that the Crow would be the first building to burn. Its operator, Brandon Hingis, would be the first executed. Maybe he meant well, but the result was the public humiliation of his people. Such a blight would need to be erased with extreme prejudice to expunge the ugly memory. Despite the common knowledge ban on most commercial venues, there were a few places Mir were tolerated so long as they didn't make trouble. Public squares were generally safe, as were bridges, beneath which many lived. They were allowed to draw water from common wells, even though the law clearly prohibited it. The Mir were also allowed to enter Grom Gallimus. They couldn't go past the Teshlaw windows, the first pair of stained glass panes that illuminated the nave and depicted the ancient imperial order, with images of grim, armored warriors who appeared to watch so that not a toe crossed the line. Still, Mir were allowed to stand inside the doors, observe the services, listen to the choir, and then wait on the steps, hoping for handouts. So long as they were respectful and didn't block access, they were granted the privilege of silent begging. As such, it wasn't odd for a Mir to trot up the marble steps and enter the giant doors of Grom Gallimus. Once more, no one looked,
No one noticed. No one cared when Vilar slipped inside for his first meeting of the night. Vilar had been a fraction late, but the bishop was more so, leaving Vilar to stand between the two stained glass teshlors. No service was underway, and the vast interior was mainly empty. The only ones there were a few boys cleaning up, and a few devoted faithful kneeling on the stone floor, praying to the statues of Novron and his doting father, Mirabor. Despite his covert mission, Vilar refused to dip his head or avert his eyes. He would not worship these gods, nor even pretend to. They were the gods of men. From either side, the Teshlors stared at him. Vilar felt uncomfortable under their watchful, sunlit gaze, a gaze that suggested they saw more than a stubborn mirror. But even as he waited, Vilar noticed the light failing and their images fading with it. Hard heels echoed. A robed figure moved through the gallery pillars. The bishop approached. When he came into view, he silently waved Vilar to a corner. They were still not past the knights, but Vilar was also not near the doors.
"Is there a problem?"
Tynwell whispered. The bishop positioned himself between Vilar and the door, blocking the view of everyone except the boys cleaning up. "No, everything is perfect."
"Then why are you here?"
"A Calaean named Erasmus Nim will need access to Grom Gallimus the morning of the feast."
Tynwell looked puzzled.
"I have an early service. People will..."
"After the service. Midday is fine. He doesn't need long to prepare."
The word prepare made the bishop wince.
"What exactly will this Erasmus person be doing? I won't allow him to desecrate the church."
"He's not going to sacrifice a goat on my altar."
Tynwell's eyes widened.
"Or a child?"
Vilar paused a moment, wondering where that had come from. He hadn't told the bishop everything. Vilar didn't think it wise, and the bishop didn't want to know the details. The only thing Tynwell cared about was that every Ulburn noble at the feast would die.
"Nim won't do anything other than what I have."
Tynwell thought a moment, then asked,
"And where will you be?"
"Someplace else. A place that I don't want Erasmus to know about."
"And what does this Erasmus fellow know about me and my involvement? Is having him use my church such a good idea? Will it point a finger my way?"
"No. This cathedral is huge, and you can't be expected to know what occurs in every crook and corner. I've already shown him where to go, and he didn't ask anything about others involved. I just wanted to let you know it would be him rather than me, in case you happened upon each other."
"And no one else knows anything, right?
You haven't bragged, have you? Gone off in some tavern about how the bishop has promised you a favor in return for arranging a murderous riot?"
"Meer aren't welcome in taverns."
"Be that as it may, the point is still valid. You haven't been drunk under some forsaken bridge, boasting about how you'll be the Duke of Rochelle when the bishop crowns himself king for lack of options, have you? If anyone discovers I'm involved, neither of us will get what we want."
"I don't drink."
Tynwell studied him carefully, then smiled.
"Good. You know, I had my doubts about you. Relying on a mirror. Such a thing doesn't come easy, but I'm a man of faith. I believe that if you show faith in someone, that someone will prove themselves worthy. This is your opportunity. Succeed, and you'll earn my trust and the rule of this city. Imagine that. You'll be a hero to your people. You'll live in the estate and govern this region on my behalf. I will be king of Ulburn, a bishop ruler, just like Venlin. And you will be the first mere noble since the fall of Meriged. You and yours will get their due. Trust me."
Vilar didn't trust him. But this was the only chance he or any of them had.
The whole affair was a terrible gamble, and there was no way to be certain the bishop would honor his pledge to appoint him duke. But it didn't matter. Left to itself, nothing would change. Villars would rather die than face another day of eating the Duke of Rochelle's trash and watching the mere people beg for scraps thrown in the street. And either way, at least Villars would have a chance to fight back. The ability to kill those who had humiliated him and his people for generations would be a worthy reward. This was something Mercator could never understand. She had become domesticated, but Villars' heart was still free. Leaving the cathedral, he stood upon the steps to watch the last of the daylight fade. He had plenty of time to reach his second appointment. He would, in fact, be incredibly early. Perhaps he should get something to eat first. He considered rummaging through the Duke's garbage for dinner, something he'd have to do just one last time. He looked down at the estate, a place that would soon be a place of honor, rather than one of humiliation. That's when he saw them, the two strangers. The foreigners who had been asking questions about the Duchess and poking around where they shouldn't. One was perched high up on the pediment at the far end of the bridge, watching the estate, as if waiting for something. Villars realized what it was, and he knew he wouldn't be getting dinner that night. Chapter 14. The Driver.
"What exactly are we looking for?" Hadrian asked, shifting his position again. The capstone he sat on was cold.
"The driver," Royce replied. The two were on the west side of the East Bridge, where Royce hadn't taken his eyes off the front gate of the Duke's estate since they'd arrived. Hadrian sat on the bridge parapet, out of the way of traffic, looking like a lost boy who'd foolishly let go of his mother's hand and hoped she'd come back. Royce was above him, perched high on the massive end pediment that announced the start or end of the bridge, depending on which way one was walking. He stood behind the statue of a winged beast, a giant, ugly bat thing with horns and fangs. Royce and the sculpture made quite the diabolical pair as he clung to a wing, peering over the stone monster's shoulder. Occasionally, the gate to the estate opened. Someone would exit or enter, and each time Royce became still and attentive. Then the gate would close, and he would settle back, disappointed. They never did find a new place to stay. All livable spaces were occupied, even the open-air patches of dirt under bridges and behind stables. Royce had continued to search until the sun threatened to set, then he insisted on a hectic race to the estate. They'd been there for more than an hour, and, so far, nothing had warranted the rush. Except for his two-word statement, Royce hadn't responded to any inquiries about their current vigil. The day had remained reasonably warm, continuing the rumor that spring was just a few steps down the road. The morning had been sunny, but afternoon had invited clouds to the party, and more were showing up all the time. A variety of boats passed beneath them. Professional fishermen hauled in nets, heading upriver after a day on Blythen Bay. The waterway also played host to a series of trawls that ran up and down river, dropping off one load of cargo at the harbour and picking up another to haul back upstream. Along the bridge, the flow of foot traffic, wagons and carriages was picking up. With slumped backs and bowed heads, servants, traders and labourers returned home, their way lit by a fading sun.
"There he is," Royce said with urgency, as he leaned forward, leering with the same malevolent expression as the statue to which he clung.
A small figure stepped outside the front gate of the ducal estate, grey-haired, partially balding. With his protruding brow and long beard, the dwarf looked like the quintessential depiction of his race. He glanced both ways before crossing the street,
and then entered the flow of traffic coming toward them.
"The dwarf," Hadrian said.
"Shh!" Royce